Due to the graphic nature of this cult's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of sexual abuse, assault, and drug use that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
In 1981, Molly Green was 14 years old. Her mother was Joyce Green, though she was calling herself Ma Jaya, and was the head of the cult known as Kashi Ashram.
Ma Jaya instructed Molly to put on a white dress, a wedding dress, in fact, and informed her that she would be married to a member of the cult named Kevin Brannon. Brannon was 25 years old.
Ma Jaya officiated the ceremony herself, which was attended by other cult members. It took place in a home in Palmetto Bay, Florida. Molly would later recall that the room was covered in mirrors and had a bar. She remembered her mother's long black hair, which she normally kept dyed. Streaks of gray were now showing through.
After the ceremony, everyone sat around the bar and ate cake. Later that night, Molly spent her first night with her new husband. As Brannon raped her repeatedly, Molly had the sensation that she left her own body. Her brain couldn't handle the trauma she was going through. She disassociated. The abuse had come with her mother's blessing.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And this is Cults. This is our second and final episode on Kashi Ashram. Brooklyn housewife Joyce Green discovered yoga as a way to lose weight, but quickly reported having visions of holy men, including Jesus Christ. She used these claims to amass hundreds of followers, but her cult eventually became engulfed in claims of kidnapping and sexual abuse.
You can listen to previous episodes of Cults, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, wherever you listen to podcasts. A new episode comes out every Tuesday.
A lot of you have asked how you can help support the show. And if you enjoy the podcast, the best way to do that is to leave a 5-star review.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram as @Parcast, and on Twitter @ParcastNetwork.
In 1976, New Yorker Joyce Green, going by the Hindu name Ma Jaya, founded the Kashi Ashram.
Joyce combined elements of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Christianity into her new religion, and her charismatic, brash personality drew in hundreds of followers. At its height, about 200 people lived at Kashi Ashram in Sebastian, Florida, though others who didn't live there still considered themselves to be devotees of Ma Jaya.
Ma Jaya died in 2012, but Kashi Ashram still exists today.
Last week, we talked about Joyce Green herself, how she discovered Hinduism by attending yoga classes, had her first visions, claimed to have experienced stigmata, and renamed herself Ma Jaya in 1974. We also learned how two figures in the counterculture scene, Hilda Charlton and Ram Dass, helped expose her to a wider audience.
Today, we'll follow Ma Jaya after she fell out with Hilda Charlton and Ram Dass and began an ashram in Florida with her most devoted followers. At the beginning of 1976, 36-year-old Ma Jaya was abandoned by her friend and follower, Ram Dass. As a best-selling author and powerful figure in the counterculture movement, he had initially encouraged people to follow Ma Jaya. But then he had turned on her, claiming that she was a fraud and that she had coerced him into promoting her.
Ma Jaya decided that she and a couple dozen of her most devoted followers needed a fresh start. She decided to relocate to Sebastian, Florida, where the land was cheap and the weather temperate.
She filed for divorce from her husband, Sal DiFiore. And in a fateful decision, Ma Jaya brought only her youngest child, Molly, with her. She left her older children, Jimmy and Denise, with their father in Brooklyn.
Sebastian is in a Florida county called Indian River Creek. It's on the east side of the state, along the Atlantic, between Orlando and Miami. It currently has only 21,000 residents and is one of the most Christian areas in the state.
Ma Jaya and her followers lived on 7 acres of land, which they rented from a local dentist. Ma Jaya had some money from donations for food and supplies, and the rest was supplemented by her followers. The land was full of brush and sand, but the group constructed a few rudimentary wooden houses where they would all sleep on the floor.
Over the next few years, the small group focused on their spiritual studies, taking classes on meditation and yoga. In some ways, their existence was idyllic. Members were able to follow their strengths, with some cooking communal meals, while others led workshops or learned at the feet of their guru. The group also constructed more solid buildings on the land. They built housing for members and also temples for worshiping different deities, statues of Buddha and Kali mixed with icons of Jesus Christ and the Virgin Mary.
But these years were not without upheaval. Former members say that when they moved to the ashram, they were expected to make large donations to Ma Jaya. They also claim they were deprived of sleep and publicly humiliated if they did something to displease her.
Ma Jaya even ordered marriages between devotees who barely knew each other. Everyone went along with it because they truly believed that she was divine.
Vanessa's going to take over on the psychology here and throughout the episode. Please note, Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Greg. Dr. John G. Clark, Jr. is one of the founders of the Boston Personal Development Institute, a nonprofit that treats former cult members. According to his research, cults will frequently gain new members by first inviting them to a special event or series of classes. Then they'll disorient the potential recruit by using group meditation, constant praying, or sleep deprivation to leave them in a vulnerable state.
And open to suggestion.
Exactly. In that state, they're much more likely to accept that the cult has the solution to all their problems. At that point, the potential recruit has become a new member.
Michelle and Jean Rousseau were two such new members. They moved to Kashi Ashram from Toronto in 1977, searching for a more meaningful existence. They brought their 12-year-old son, Paul, with them, and two older daughters came to join them later.
They said that Ma Jaya was obsessed with other people's children. She would insert herself into the parent-child dynamic, oftentimes usurping the parental role. They speculated that it was partly because children are easier to indoctrinate than adults.
Ma Jaya persuaded the Rousseaus to give her all their money. Jean said they went along with it initially because they believed Ma Jaya was the key to their happiness.
But in 1978, after they had lived on the ranch for a year, Ma Jaya ordered Michelle to move out of the room she shared with her husband and son and into a garage. Michelle wasn't sure why she was ordered to do so and publicly disagreed with Ma Jaya over the issue.
Michelle decided to leave the ashram, and her husband Jean eventually followed her. But their three children, including 13-year-old Paul, refused to leave. They were all under Ma Jaya's influence.
Ma Jaya especially favored their son, Paul, perhaps because he was the youngest and also quite intelligent. Paul was brought into Ma Jaya's inner circle, and Ma Jaya fought any action by his parents to remove him.
Also, in 1978, an event hundreds of miles away from the ashram would end up increasing the public's critical view of Ma Jaya and her followers.
Like Ma Jaya, cult leader Jim Jones had begun a spiritual movement out of people's dissatisfaction with mainstream religion in the 1960s. He called it the People's Temple.
While the People's Temple initially started with promises of racial and economic equality, Jones eventually revealed himself to be a destructive cult leader.
He convinced his followers to move to Guyana to start a settlement, which was rife with abuse and violence. When outsiders threatened to expose his kingdom for what it was, Jones commanded his followers to drink punch laced with cyanide. 918 men, women, and children were killed.
The outside world was horrified. It was the single largest loss of American civilian life in history.
It resulted in increased scrutiny of cults as the public and news media tried to ascertain if there were other cults out there and if they could result in the same kind of violence.
Ma Jaya was apparently horrified by the Jonestown murders. She also realized that Kashi Ashram needed to go on the offensive.
In 1979, Ma Jaya opened a school on the 7-acre property. She called it the River School, and its purpose was to educate the children of both cult members and nearby Sebastian residents. Ma Jaya's decision to build the school could have been altruistic, but it was also a smart marketing move. With the increased scrutiny from Jonestown, Kashi Ashram needed to be seen as giving back to the community. We'll hear more about Ma Jaya's outreach in a moment.
Now, back to the story. In 1980, she had met a man named Susei Cho. Cho was originally from Korea and was an 8th-degree Taekwondo black belt. He traveled to the U.S. to teach the martial art and eventually came into contact with Ma Jaya. The specifics of their meeting aren't public, but they married at Kashi Ashram in 1981.
Ma Jaya desperately wanted children with Cho. The couple got pregnant several times, but Ma Jaya miscarried each pregnancy. The losses devastated her and left her concerned about who would take over when she died.
She decided to try to assert her control over the children who were already at the ashram. Paul Brousseau's parents had left 4 years earlier, but they were still fighting for custody of him. In 1981, when Paul was only 16, Ma Jaya tried to get him to marry an older woman at the ashram in order to get around his parents' guardianship.
At that point, the Rousseaus sought help from a lawyer. Because Paul was still a minor, the lawyer was able to get a court order granting custody to his parents.
On December 11, 1981, a 9-member team from the Miami-Dade Police Department entered the ashram and escorted Paul back to his parents. Because the twin daughters were no longer minors, they were free to choose to stay on the ranch, which they did.
Paul says Ma Jaya instructed him to break everything in his parents' home, accuse his mother of raping him, and run away. In fact, after he was returned to his parents in Canada, he tried to run away twice. But with some time and distance away from the cult, Paul was finally able to see that he had been manipulated.
It wasn't so easy for his older sisters. It took them 5 more years to get out of the ashram. Their mother described them as emotionally withdrawn when they finally got out and said that they needed extensive therapy to recover.
According to Dr. Clark, children are especially affected by being in cults. If they're able to get out, they might show symptoms including depression, guilt, fear, paranoia, slow speech, rigidity of facial expression and body posture, indifference to physical appearance, passivity, and memory impairment.
Paul Rousseau later became an applied physics graduate student at Stanford University. He now feels sympathy for the children in the cult because they're not raised to have a mind of their own, saying, "The children born in the sect, they don't have a chance in hell. It all makes me terribly sad to think about it. It's kind of like living as a domesticated animal."
After Paul was taken from her, Ma Jaya decided to take a different approach to keeping children in the cult. At that time, couples in the cult had to ask Ma Jaya for permission to have a baby. In fact, they weren't supposed to have sex at all, even married couples, unless they were specifically trying to procreate.
One such couple was Roseanne Henry and Harry Brody. They asked Ma Jaya for permission to conceive in 1980. In 1981, Roseanne became pregnant and was soon approached by members of Ma Jaya's inner circle with a strange request.
They told her that Ma Jaya wanted to raise the baby as her own, with an eye toward making the child her successor. They stressed that it was a high honor for Roseanne's child to even be considered, as the child would essentially be the son or daughter of God. But the parents had to agree that the child would be raised to believe that Ma Jaya was their real mother.
Roseanne agreed. She later explained her decision like this. "Think of it this way. Let's say you're a Catholic, and the Blessed Virgin Mary asks you to give her your child." That's what it was like.
Roseanne was pressured into falsifying her daughter's birth certificate so that it would list her biological mother as Joyce Cho. Joyce was Ma Jaya's real first name, and she had legally changed her last name to her new husband's.
To help with the deception, Roseanne dyed her hair jet black, like Ma Jaya's, before going to the hospital to deliver her daughter. That way, if there were questions asked later, hospital workers would describe someone generally fitting Ma Jaya's appearance.
Roseanne and Harry then gave their child, a daughter named Tess, to Ma Jaya to raise as her own. In 1982, the couple decided that they wanted to leave the cult, but because they had falsified Tess's birth certificate, they weren't able to take her with them.
Ma Jaya had also convinced Roseanne that she wasn't fit to be a mother, that she was too childish and irresponsible. Roseanne believed that by leaving Tess in Ma Jaya's care, she was really doing the best thing for her.
It might seem shocking for a mother to give up her child, But according to Dr. Stanley H. Kath, a psychoanalyst and professor at Tufts University Medical School, engagement in cults can actually rewire a person's brain. By depriving a person of sleep and immersing them in group activities like monotonous chanting, a cult can actually change the wiring in a member's temporal lobe. That change can result in an altered personality and heightened suggestibility.
Luckily, once out of the cult, Roseanne began to heal. She eventually became a therapist and even started counseling former cult members.
She realized how she'd been manipulated by Ma Jaya and decided that she wanted to take care of her daughter again.
She hired a lawyer to battle Ma Jaya and the ashram for custody of their daughter. The cult ignored requests to hand Tess over to the government, so officials were forced to escalate their efforts. On July 19, 1989, a SWAT team from the Indian River County Sheriff's Department stormed a movie theater in Vero Beach, where Tess and other children from Kashi Ashram had gone for an outing.
After Tess was returned to her parents, she had a long road ahead of her. Tess would even pray to Ma Jaya at the dinner table because she believed that Ma Jaya was God.
The Colorado State Health and Rehabilitative Services performed an evaluation of Tess when she was returned to her parents and found that Tess had a desperate need for attention because she had been ignored by Joyce and Cho at the ashram, and that she had been deprived of a chance to develop a full range of emotions.
Ma Jaya was outraged that Tess had been taken from her. She had people working for Kashi Ashram follow Tess around and leave gifts at the front door of the family's home in Colorado.
Roseanne at one point considered hiring a bodyguard for her daughter, but eventually Ma Jaya seemed to realize that her attempts were futile and left Tess alone, though Tess continued to have nightmares about her time at the ashram.
They weren't the only couple who were approached about giving their child to Ma Jaya. At least three other couples, including Gina and Richard Rosencrantz, agreed to give their child to Ma Jaya to raise. All the parents signed the birth certificates with Joyce Cho as the biological mother, with some also listing Su Se Cho as the biological father.
Ma Jaya later claimed that she had only taken the children because the mothers didn't want them and had threatened to get abortions. She said that the only way for her to save the children was for her to tell the mothers that she would take responsibility for them.
Other cult members disagreed with this assertion, saying that it was clear that the parents were ready and willing to raise the children on their own.
The early 1980s were clearly a tumultuous time for Kashi Ashram. Disaffected members would even refer to these years as the Rampage Years because of Ma Jaya's frequently bizarre behavior.
Harry Brody was a member of Kashi Ashram in 1981. He says that he worked 50-hour weeks as a physician while living at the ashram and was then required to stay up until 3 a.m. listening to Ma Jaya's lectures. He also claimed that Ma Jaya used cocaine nightly, and her usage contributed to paranoia that at one point led to an attempt to slash him with a razor blade.
She would also instruct her followers to engage in bizarre crafts, like making fur-lined boxes for no reason, and at times even encourage them to hit each other to work out karma. Karma is a Buddhist belief that positive and negative actions will always initiate a corresponding positive or negative reaction down the line.
Ma Jaya justified her drug use by saying that it was her way of taking on the sins of the world. It wasn't the first time she'd been accused of taking drugs.
Her colleague Ram Dass asserted that she used to take energy pills back when they were still teaching in New York, but would pretend that her energy came from some spiritual gift rather than the pills.
Also in the early 1980s, one of the Rousseau daughters, Jean, said she witnessed a disturbing punishment. A man was accused by another cult member of abusing a child in the cult, but Ma Jaya didn't want to involve the police. They were already facing enough outside scrutiny.
Instead, she had the man's arm held over a lit candle until he had been severely burned, hoping that the scar would remind him not to molest any more children in the cult.
Ma Jaya also punished the child victim of the molester. She colored his penis black with a magic marker and made him walk around the ashram naked in front of dozens of people.
But while these incidents were occurring, Ma Jaya was also beginning important service to the community. In 1981, the first cases of what is now known as AIDS were reported.
People were terrified. They weren't sure what the disease was or how it spread. Members of the LGBT community were vilified and ostracized.
But Ma Jaya reached out to the LGBT community and others suffering from the HIV virus. She was hands-on with them, unlike others who feared that touching patients could give them the disease. She urged people in the medical community and the world at large to pay attention to these disenfranchised people when many found it easier to turn their backs.
A cynical view might be that Ma Jaya needed to perform a public relations makeover, and that's why she devoted so much care to this cause. But even if that's the case, she has unquestionably raised millions of dollars for AIDS patients and cared for patients as they died in her arms.
During the rest of the 80s and 90s, the cult seemed to enter a more peaceful time. Ma Jaya's charitable work continued, and the ashram grew.
Ma Jaya even met the Pope. At the time, the Catholic Church was ignoring the existence of AIDS and the suffering of those living with the disease.
Ma Jaya flew to Rome, hoping to get a private meeting with Pope John Paul II. She wasn't granted one, so she waited in a long line at a public conference to meet him. When she was finally at the front of the line, she showed the Pope a photo album containing graphic photos of people dying from AIDS. The Pope blessed the album, and people credited Ma Jaya with helping to bring the realities of the epidemic to his attention.
But even though Ma Jaya was building up goodwill for her charitable deeds, she still had detractors within her ranks. Some were even within her own family.
We'll name those detractors in just a moment. Now, back to the story.
In the 1980s, around 150 people lived at the Kashi Ashram, but others considered themselves followers of Ma Jaya even though they didn't live there. The members paid rent between $350 and $600 per month, plus an extra $200 for food and $75 for mandatory monthly medical exams. In today's currency, that amounts to around $1,200 to $1,700. Members were also expected to give Ma Jaya gifts and pay for her vacations.
Kashi Ashram supported itself through three main income streams. The first was dues and donations from members. The second was a business selling martial arts equipment that Susei Cho, Ma Jaya's husband, had started, and which brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. The third was Ma Jaya's foundation to sell her homemade religious-inspired artwork, such as paintings of the Virgin Mary or the Hindi goddess Kali.
In addition to Ma Jaya's work with AIDS patients, the school run by Kashi Ashram also brought in good publicity for the group. The River School, as it was called, began accepting students from the Sebastian community who weren't children of members. And in 1990, the school hired a team from Rutgers University to review the school. The team wrote a positive report about the environment at the River School, giving the ashram a stronger sense of legitimacy.
But some members questioned Ma Jaya's habit of using public shaming to keep the children in line. At nightly darshans, or spiritual meetings, Ma Jaya would call up the children who had misbehaved in school.
She knew who to call up because the principal of the school would provide her with what they called a rat list. In front of the whole ashram, the children would be admonished for their misbehavior.
The Rutgers team called this practice an acceptable way to make sure that children followed rules, one that has been used by various societies and institutions throughout history. But many members were uncomfortable with it and believed the team only saw what Ma Jaya wanted them to see.
One member who saw behind the scenes of Kashi Ashram was Sal Conti. He first saw Ma Jaya speak in 1976. He was entranced and moved to the ashram soon after.
In his previous life, Conti had been a jeweler and sculptor. So when Ma Jaya started selling her art, she asked him to help market it. Once he was in Ma Jaya's inner circle, he started to see his guru in a different light.
He said that Ma Jaya traveled frequently, and sometimes she wasn't where she told her followers she was. During two subsequent summers, she told people at Kashi Ashram that she was helping the poor in Utah.
In fact, she was staying at a pricey villa in Aspen, recovering from facelifts. For the record, Ma Jaya has admitted to having face peels, but she claims she has never had a facelift.
Conti says Ma Jaya had another expensive habit. gambling. He claims that she spent ashram funds on cards and slot machines. She would frequently tell her followers that she was meditating on retreats when she was actually gambling at casinos. Sometimes in the middle of a gambling spree, she would call the ashram to request more money from her followers.
In 1995, Mahjaya, Kanti, and several other followers were in New Orleans to catch a connecting flight. Mahjaya decided to stay overnight in the city with Kanti so she could gamble.
At a riverboat casino called the River Queen, Kanti saw Mahjaya gamble away $25,000 to $30,000 on slot machines. Mahjaya did get a $100,000 salary from the ashram, but Kanti says this was money earmarked for other purposes.
High-ranking members of Mahjaya's inner circle were already aware of her gambling problem. Some dismissed the issue, believing that the good she did for the poor and suffering made up for it. Others believed that because Mahjaya was divine, she sometimes acted in ways that they simply could not understand.
But that wasn't the worst thing that Kanti witnessed at the ashram. In 1996, Mahjaya questioned a 13-year-old boy named Wang Chun Rosenkrantz, the son of Richard and Gina Rosenkrantz. They were one of the couples who had signed Mahjaya's name to their child's birth certificate, and Wang Chun was raised as Mahjaya's son.
Mahjaya became convinced that Wang Chun had had sex with a young woman at the ashram. Wang Chun refused to admit it, and Mahjaya became enraged.
Kanti witnessed masked men sent by Mahjaya approach Wang Chun in a garden temple at the ashram. They duct-taped his mouth, then beat him with socks stuffed with rocks.
But Mahjaya wasn't satisfied. A few weeks later, she ordered another attack on Wang Chun, but this time, she wanted to be able to see it.
Again in masks, the men beat Wang Chun in full view of Mahjaya's house. She stood in a window with Kanti and other members to watch the attack. As Wang Chun cried, Kanti heard Mahjaya say, "Hit him harder."
After seeing behind the curtain of Mahjaya's operation, Kanti left the ashram. He now lives in Long Island and is trying to reestablish himself as a jeweler.
But Wang Chun remained on the ashram. His father left the ashram in 1999, and in 2001, he filed for divorce from his wife, Gina. The divorce battle got nasty and resulted in a lot of negative attention for the ashram.
In the midst of the divorce, 19-year-old Wang Chun sued his father, saying he wanted control over a trust that his grandmother had left for him. Richard claimed that Mahjaya had ordered Wang Chun to sue him to distract from the divorce.
Richard had been the chief media spokesman for the ashram, so he had an insider's view of what went on there. He further claimed that the ashram was a destructive cult. He and Gina had been coerced into giving their son to Mahjaya to raise, and that Gina and Wang Chun were still under Mahjaya's control.
He used the beating of Wang Chun to back up his claims, saying he had become aware of what had happened only after he'd left the ashram. But Wang Chun claimed he had made up that story. He admitted that he had told his father that he'd been attacked, but now said that he'd lied and that it was a stupid thing to do.
Richard gathered expert witnesses on cults and former members willing to testify to the ashram's abuses, and everything played out in the media. For Kashi Ashram, it was a public relations nightmare.
But somehow, the cult still managed to keep going. Its toughest hits were still to come, though.
Mahjaya had left two of her children with her husband in New York when she moved to Florida, taking only her youngest daughter, Molly, with her.
Her two older children, Denise and Jimmy, did their best without their mother. Jimmy was 14 when she left. His family says that, like his mother, he was street smart, tough, and charismatic.
He was also obsessed with dirt bikes, and his father, Sal, got him into boxing after his mother left, hoping it would be an outlet for him. After he finished high school, he got a Coca-Cola delivery route, just like his father. The two were very close and even started a business together in 1993 called Alpine Vending.
But Jimmy never got over his mother's abandonment. It must have been difficult for a child to understand how his mother had so much time for other people, but none for her children.
Even Mahjaya's most devoted followers understood that life must be difficult for her children. One member who was born into the cult recalled thinking, quote, "I can't imagine being a family member of Ma. It would be such a terrible thing. You want your mom to be there. Ma had so much love and energy, but it wasn't focused on her children," end quote.
After his mother left, Jimmy struggled with depression and later an addiction to drugs. He was married for a time and had children, but eventually he and his wife divorced.
Sometimes Jimmy would be in the middle of a conversation with his family and he would suddenly grow quiet, his eyes glazing over. His voice would grow choked with emotion and he'd ask, "Why did she leave us? How could she abandon us like that?"
He did speak to his mother on the phone at times, and she would reassure him of his importance to her, telling him, "Jimmy, you're my eyes. You're my life and soul."
But Jimmy was never able to get over her initial abandonment. In May of 2004, Jimmy checked into a hospital in Staten Island. His depression and drug addiction was too much, and he needed help.
He stayed there for a week and called his younger sister Molly, who had grown up at the Kashi Ashram, every night. Molly called their mother to let her know that Jimmy needed help. But Ma Jaya, who had so much compassion for others, had none for her own son.
Molly recalled her mother telling her over the phone, quote, "You selfish bitch. I have people dying of AIDS and a student dying of cancer on Kashi and have much more important things to worry about," end quote.
Jimmy checked out of the hospital. For the next week, he talked obsessively about his mother, wondering how she could ignore him.
On May 31st, 2004, Jimmy left black and white photographs of him and his mother around his Staten Island apartment. He put on an Elvis album and went into the bathroom. He lay a blanket on the floor, then swallowed a mix of painkillers. He then lay on top of the blanket and cut his left arm from elbow to wrist. He bled out on the bathroom floor.
When Ma Jaya heard about his suicide, she was devastated. On June 9th of 2004, she wrote an email to her followers about how close she and Jimmy were. She claimed that Jimmy was proud of her for helping others, and that his last words to her were, "I love you more than anyone, Mommy. I just want to sleep."
Clearly, the rest of her family had a different perception of their relationship. Jimmy's 13-year-old daughter, Alexa, found the email and decided to write one of her own.
On the night of June 12th, she wrote an email to all of the ashram's followers that read in part, quote, "This may be hard to hear or believe, but as long as you have lived on the ranch, you have been lied to. My grandmother didn't care about my dad when he was alive, and she definitely doesn't now. My dad had a lot of mental problems, and Joyce just added to them. She helped to kill him," end quote.
We don't know how Alexa's email went over in the ashram, but no further correspondence was made public, and the next decade at the ashram was a prosperous one. The ashram grew, eventually buying 80 acres of land in Sebastian, Florida. Several residential buildings, temples, and a senior center were built across it. They also opened several smaller centers across the country in cities like Los Angeles, where members do outreach to the homeless.
The ashram also gained some celebrity fans. Folk singer Arlo Guthrie became a member and still keeps a room at the ashram for when he visits. Julia Roberts came across Ma Jaya in her research for the movie Eat, Pray, Love and considered her a hugely positive influence on herself and her family. Ivana Trump hosted a fundraiser for the ashram on her yacht.
But the ashram was about to face its biggest test. On January 13th, 2012, Ma Jaya was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Although Ma Jaya had claimed in the past that she could take on other people's cancer for them and then clear the tumors from her body, she was unable to beat her own illness.
She passed away on April 13th, 2012, at age 71. She was in the company of ashram members, and a thunderstorm appeared just after she died, which they interpreted as being in her honor.
Several hundred people attended her funeral, where they sang Hindi chants and covered her coffin with rose petals. Her obituary listed her as having three additional children, the ones that her followers had given her, or been forced to give her, including Wang Chun.
Despite all the charges that had come up over the years against her, Ma Jaya was still celebrated by her followers. In the end, her charismatic personality and ability to connect with people won out over everything else.
According to psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who wrote the definitive book on cults and thought reform, the number one defining characteristic of a cult is a charismatic leader who increasingly becomes an object of worship.
Not only was Ma Jaya charismatic, she also proclaimed herself to be an actual deity at times.
Yes, and another defining characteristic of a cult is the sexual or financial exploitation of its members. We've heard that Ma Jaya insisted on large donations and gifts from Kashi Ashram members.
And her own child, Molly, could attest to the group's sexual exploitation. On the morning of April 14, 2012, Molly was at her home in Pennsylvania, where she lived with her husband. She received a text from an ashram member confirming that her mother had died.
She felt a curious mix of relief and sadness at the news. But when her husband, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh, came home, her emotions overwhelmed her.
She first recalled that, "A weight was lifted off me. It was the happiest day of my life."
But the lightness only lasted for a short time, before she was besieged by disturbing memories. She recalled specific instances from her childhood as though she were watching them in a movie. She said, quote, "I had memories of a man groping me. I said to my husband, I think something happened to me as a kid," end quote.
Only after Ma Jaya's death was Molly able to retrieve the traumatic memories of her childhood. She finally remembered that 30 years ago, when she was 14 years old, her mother had forced her to marry a 25-year-old ashram member named Kevin Brannan.
She recalled that beginning in 1979, her mother groomed her to believe that having sex with an adult was normal. Her mother used drugs and alcohol to get Molly used to the idea that girls her age in the ashram should have sex with adult men, with the ultimate goal to be to give birth to children that would then be raised by Ma Jaya.
She remembered the night of her wedding in 1981, when Ma Jaya told her to put on a wedding dress and officiated the ceremony between her and Kevin at a home in Palmetto Bay. That night, Kevin raped Molly repeatedly. A week later, Ma Jaya gave Molly a pregnancy test, which was negative. Thankfully, the marriage wasn't legally binding because there was no marriage certificate, and Molly was underage, and she was eventually able to escape.
Dr. Jim Hopper, a nationally recognized consultant on childhood sexual assault and trauma, says that children often repress memories of abuse as a defense mechanism.
So the child pushes the memory away in order to survive. It's too much for the child to deal with.
Some never recover the memory, while others may recover it later in life, either spontaneously or with the help of therapy. In Molly's case, she wasn't able to deal with the memory until her mother died because she still thought of her mother as a threat.
In 2013, Molly filed a civil suit against Kashi Ashram, Kevin Brannan, and Carolyn Huttner, who represented Ma Jaya's estate.
The ashram claimed that Molly was bitter that she was excluded from Ma Jaya's will and was seeking money. Molly countered that she didn't care about money and only wanted people to know the truth about her mother.
She also had multiple witnesses state that they remembered when Ma Jaya announced that she had married her daughter to Brannan.
They recalled gathering around a speakerphone at the ashram to listen to Ma Jaya from the home in Palmetto Bay. She went over various aspects of life at the ashram and then mentioned that she had married her daughter to Brannan.
The members listening exchanged confused glances, but they all assumed that Ma Jaya wouldn't hurt her own daughter.
Eventually, the press around Molly's accusation died down, especially because there were no further court filings. It's likely that the ashram and Molly settled the suit out of court.
Despite the revelations about Ma Jaya, the accusations of assault, misuse of ashram funds, the handling of her son's suicide, and her daughter's molestation, Kashi Ashram continues on to this day.
Around 200 people still live at the ashram in Sebastian, Florida, where Ma Jaya is still revered.
Is it possible that without Ma Jaya's influence, her cult could take the positive elements of her teaching and move forward? Or is there still darkness lurking under the benevolent mission of Kashi Ashram?
Thanks again for tuning into Cults. We'll be back next Tuesday with a new episode.
Some of you have asked how you can help the show. If you enjoy Cults, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. You can find Cults and all of Parcast's podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or on your favorite podcast directory.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram as @Parcast and Twitter @ParcastNetwork.
We'll see you next time.
Cults was created by Max Cutler and is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Aidan Connolly, Maggie Admire, and Carly Madden. Cults is written by Claire Epstein and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson.